Hello and welcome to our INE office hours call for the month of April 2017. These are calls that are open to folks that are in various programs. For those of you who recently joined the IRSPT program, the insulin resistance program, welcome. You guys are getting access to these calls. For those of you who are in the NEPT program, you're in for the long haul, so you get access to these calls for a couple of years. For those of you in IRSPT, I think you get 4 or 5 months of it, 6 months maybe, I'm not sure. And as you join other programs, people join other programs. So there's a wide variety of questions that we handle on these calls. Some of them are related to digestion. Some of them are related to insulin and blood sugar, and others are just all over the map. So the way that we work these calls is there's a couple of ways that you can ask questions. One is there's a Q&A box over to the right-hand side when you click the link to get in. You can type your questions there. I prefer the questions you want me to address to be there and then leave the chat for dialogue back and forth, because from a perspective of just a logistical perspective, they go flying by pretty quickly, and I don't always catch all the questions there. But if you have an actual question you want me to address, then put it in the Q&A, and those are kind of static, and it allows me to scroll through them, so I get control. I like control. It's one of my things. All right, so I've got, it looks like there's 3 questions, 2 from Shamima and 1 from Dasha. The other way to ask questions is to do a *2 on your telephone keypad. So I'm happy to talk to you about patient labs, about particular questions in assessments, all those sorts of things. But what these are not is something that we do in NEPT is what we call a case study call, where you upload a bunch of labs and the whole history of the person, and we answer that. So if you're going to upload labs to be looked at, say you're in insulin resistance and you just had a whole, you know, hemoglobin A1C and glucose and insulin and all, and you want me to take a look at it, then there's a number of things. If it's just a handful of lab values, then you can just throw those into the question and answer box. But if not, and it's a full, you know, you want me to look at more than just a handful of things, then you need to upload them. But we like to get them. We need to get them. I'm not just going to say we like to get them. We need to get them at least 24 hours in advance, preferably 72 hours, because what it takes from our perspective is to download the files and then upload them to my computer and then have them available for me to look at. And if we get it, like, the morning of, then I'm in calls all the way up to that, then it's a scramble to try to look at that. So for the future, we're not gonna even accept labs that are uploaded the same day. You know, if you put a couple of things in the Q&A, we can look at those that way. So I want to make this really open and accessible to everybody so that, you know, we can get through a lot of questions, because oftentimes we have a lot of folks on the call. So what I'm going to do is start with the ones that were typed in advance. And so if you can't make one of these calls, but there's some questions you want to get an answer to, what you do is you click on the link that's either on the schedule page or in the email that you get, and you just type your question in there. So I like to start with those first. That way I can handle all the ones that came in before the call. So if you can't make it, you know that you can hear your answer right at the beginning of the call. And then we'll move on to the ones that are typed in after that and also to your questions as you type it in, as you raise your hands. Interesting, it looks like Patricia came in 3 times. I don't understand. Maybe you're having trouble with your line, but I see you there 3 times. MPLS is what it shows as your city. I'm not sure where that is. All right, so we have Melody and we have Tony and Lynn and Susan. And Melody, you're there twice too. So I wonder if there's something going on with the web call that you guys are not hearing through it. Because I wasn't hearing anything earlier. Good. MPLS, according to Lynn, is Minneapolis. Yes, so Patricia, you're in there twice. 3 times. And Melody, you're in there twice. And Shonda just joined us. And Thompson, Jay Thompson, is that Jenny, no, who's there? Jay Thompson, somebody from East Boston. I'm drawing a blank on who that might be. All right, so let me start with the Q&A. And we have Shamima. On Facebook, I mentioned that if we do keto right, our blood sugar will be low. What do you consider the right way to do keto? If I have a client doing keto, what changes would you recommend? So when I say do keto right, it means to actually get a person into ketosis. So if a person's in ketosis, generally their blood sugar is going to go plummeting because they don't need the sugar, right? They just need the, they're going to live off the ketones. So the, when I say do it right and how do you know, you basically would be testing the strips, you know, the ketone strips you can do. You can buy the blood ketone strips, which are rather pricey, like about $2.50 per strip, or the urine, which isn't as accurate, but it will give you a general idea if you're in ketosis. But the other thing is if a person's blood sugar goes down into the 40s, 50s, 60s, and they're feeling awesome, they're most likely in ketosis. 60s, maybe not so much. Some people live very well on 60s. But I know for myself, I get into ketosis pretty quickly. Some people, it takes a long time. For me, I just have to do a fast for a day or a half day even sometimes, and I find myself in ketosis. I was doing a liver flush a few weeks ago with Jane, and the one day was just smoothies, and it was a very light day. The next day was just juices and mostly water. And by that night, I was feeling great. Everything looks great. And I went and checked my blood sugar, and it was 47. And I went, nah, there's something wrong. Okay, I did it again. It was 46. And then, okay, so I'm in ketosis, right? And when I say do it right, I just basically mean doing it in such a way that you bring the sugars down low enough, the carbs down low enough that the body starts to burn fat. For a lot of people, it takes 3 days to make that transition if it's extreme low. For some people, it takes 3 weeks to fully make that transition. And for other lucky people like me, I can do it in less than a day. From my perspective, doing a ketogenic diet right means that you're not completely restricting all the good low-starch vegetables. Now, for some people, they need to get into ketosis, and they have more, I believe, metabolic imbalances than the person who gets there pretty quickly. But you don't want to put somebody on a diet, like a ketogenic diet would be like, you know, you sit around eating pork lard all day long and have, a steak with it and a couple of eggs, and there you go. You can be in ketosis, low carb, moderate protein, high fat. Not a healthy way to do it. I like to focus on people getting, when they're doing a ketogenic diet, the fats coming as much from whole food fats as they can. But for some people where they have to go below 10 or some people even 5 grams of carb each day, that doesn't even allow for much in the way of almonds or chia seeds or any of those things. Whereas another person might be able to just get fine into ketosis in under 50, in which case they can use more whole food fats and more of the whole vegetables. So it's a tricky thing, and there's some new products on the market. Well, there's some that have been on for a while that are basically ketones. Most of the ketone products I've looked at are junky. They have artificial sweeteners, they have caffeine, they have other things that are undesirable. The only one I've seen so far that I like is from Julian Bakery, and it's called InstaKetone. I don't have any stock in the company, anything. I just like the product, and I've been experimenting with it with a couple of people, and one of my people was able to get into ketosis, measured on the blood sticks, which are very accurate, within a couple of hours and maintain it all day long. So we're doing an experiment with her right now. I bought the powder to experiment on myself, but haven't really been disciplined enough to start doing it. But that's what I meant by that. So great questions. Shamima on Facebook. Okay, same question. So it's only 2 questions. Dasha from the UK. Hi, Dasha. I struggle with the vitamin C calibration. What is the reason to do it, and is it safe, for example, to do with a client with ALS? I find it very complicated to understand the procedure. Also, I'm into Module 3 of IRSBT and feel overwhelmed by the amount of information and lost without a tutor. Is there mentoring? So mentoring as part of the course is use the Facebook group if you're lost and use these calls if you're lost. So, yeah, there's a lot of information, and it's step-by-step. Take it at your own pace. But, yeah, if you have questions, formulate particular questions and ask them, and we're happy to help you. Yeah. So we're looking at possibly starting in July, because all these calls are scheduled out through then, doing an alternation of day-night. That way we don't have people. But if you're in the UK and we have it during the day, this is not the middle of the night for you, hon. If we did it at night, it would be. So these calls are at 2 p.m., which is 8 o'clock at night for you, so it's not in the middle of the night. So I would really encourage you to come on live. The night calls would be the ones that the UK folks would have trouble with, because those would put it certainly in the middle of the night if we did it 7 p.m. here. So yeah, I'd encourage you to come on to these calls, because you should still be up. It's 8 o'clock in the evening. And ask your questions and do it on Facebook and post them here. So as far as vitamin C calibration, it's actually quite simple a process. And we give you a lot of the nuances to explain it. But there's other things to do. The reason for it is to find out what a person's optimal amount of vitamin C is. I mean, we could just pull numbers out of the sky and say, hey, take 1,000 milligrams 3 times a day, and that may be great for one person. It may be too much for another person, and it may be too little to really get the profound changes that vitamin C as an antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, et cetera, can do, antimicrobial. So we try to get that going. So there's two ways to calibrate and find the bowel tolerance. One, the slower way, is that you start them with 1,000 milligrams 3 times a day. If they get diarrhea from that, then you back it off. If they don't, then you just gradually keep increasing. I usually like to increase in 500 milligram components. So the next day, maybe you add a 500 milligrams to one of those 3 doses, and then 500 more. So you go slowly, and when they start to get the looser stools or gas or bloating, then you back off. That's one way. The calibration itself is set up so that they start with, in the morning, you plan out the day being, that you don't have to go anywhere because you're going to be doing this calibration. So you do it and you take, I think the recommended dose was like a half a teaspoon, which would be equivalent of like a gram or 2 grams probably, a dose. And then half an hour later, you do it again and again and again. And you just keep taking that dose, writing down how much you took so you could keep track. And then once you get that watery diarrhea like you gave yourself an enema, then that's the end. There are few people that can't do it. People with really bad irritable bowel will get to that level before they actually hit their bowel tolerance. So you don't want to do it with somebody with irritable bowel. It usually is not a fun thing to do. There are some people who are so depleted that they've taken 120 milligrams before they got there. Very, very depleted. And realistically, they're not going to be taking 75% of that on a daily basis. Very difficult to do. Those are the people I usually like to refer out to get IV vitamin C treatments for a while so they can build up their levels. But basically, it's you're taking them and, you know, read it through. What I would recommend, read through the process and then just make yourself some notes. And if you have questions about any particular steps, then post them to the Facebook group or post them for here for the next call. So thank you. All right, I'm going to look to see if there's other questions. All right, hands up. Anybody have questions? Susan, I know you had submitted some labs, and I have those open on my – well, I don't have them open yet on my screen. I downloaded them. There's a lot of steps to this process, so let me open them. And if you have particular questions about this, these are complicated cases, so to go through a complete OAT test on one of these calls might not be doable, but we can certainly answer questions, and I can point out some things that are problematic. So let me see. Those are better for the NEPT ones. Okay, let me open up your thing, Susan. Which are the ones from today? Okay, 1, 2.
And Dr. Bruin, can you hear me okay?
I can.
Okay, wonderful. Hi.
I am now. Hi. Yeah, I was telling Lynn that the oats are much better on the NEPT calls just because we have more time. And
yeah.
You know, without a history on a note, it's like I'm going to ask you lots of questions about this person. So
yeah.
First of all, the way I'd like to start is if you have any particular questions that came up as you went through it, that would be the best place to start.
Not any specific questions yet, but there's two things here. One is a moat, which was done originally in April of 2016. And then this client wasn't retested until the 1st of March, 2017. So she went quite a while without being retested. and I started working with her in February. So her moat, of course, indicated.
Okay, so tell me the difference between them. I say, no, it says microbial, but it's looking like it's the same.
Yeah, so the first page is pretty much the same, but then the oat includes the amino acids, the neurotransmitters.
Oh, so this just includes the microbial stuff. Got it.
Right.
And it has a couple of microbial markers. Got it. Okay. Yep.
Yeah. And my biggest concern, you probably don't remember me mentioning this, but she had on the original moat a very high 4 Cresol number of 90. That's on line item number 17.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And even though she had been on a very strict they were putting her doctor, that is, and the nutritionist were putting her on different diets, specifically a FODMAP diet. And he also had her taking the same probiotics without changing them up, had her rotating two different antifungal supplements. But this went on for almost a year without retesting, and she was still having C. diff type symptoms. And, you know, C. diff is on my radar because my dad's had it a few times. I see this 4 Cresol marker. It's one of the worst out of the Clostridia markers here. And so as it turns out, on the new test, that number did decrease. But she's still having symptoms. Basically, she's a run-to-the-toilet kind of person with uncontrollable bowel movements. And fortunately, the doctor just recently reinforced what I suggested to her, which is that she stop eating dairy.
Oh, she's been eating dairy this whole time?
Yeah. It was very strange because they were having her reintroduce certain foods back, like yogurt or soy milk, and it was like, why?
Why? You didn't get results yet. You don't introduce things back, first of all. You know, so when you're doing an elimination diet, you eliminate, and if you don't get the reduction in symptoms that you expect, you eliminate more. You move things around, and certainly you take somebody off the top 6 allergens without saying, and FODMAPs doesn't include dairy. So,
Yeah, they had her on that, and then they had her on elimination, sorry. So they were, you know, reintroducing things, but she was still having symptoms.
You don't introduce when things have symptoms. So I'm looking at this, and I was wondering, you know, why did they just go with antifungals, but apparently it did lower it. Did they do any antibacterial type herbs when she was originally?
There was
bunch of bacterial markers.
There was one antimicrobial, the Para Botanic Select, mm-hmm. that she was taking, and then the other one was the complementary Candida complex. So she was rotating those. She was only taking one antimicrobial, but I mean, basically, she was rotating on these two things every other week for almost a year.
And in addition, stool test on her to see if she's not getting better. I want to do a stool test to see what the heck is actually growing there.
So this is why. I suggested she go and do an oat test because obviously with malabsorption, she's going to have some serious malnutrition
going on. Yeah. So the new one, I'm looking at the old one compared to the new one. On the old one, she had mostly, she had the arabinose and slightly higher in tricarboxylic, but mostly just that arabinose. And then under bacterial, she was in the higher range, not necessarily out of range, but for piperic and hydroxybenzoic. And then, of course, the 4 Cresol. So if I look at the new one, the 4 Cresol is in normal range.
Yeah.
All the Clostridia markers are in normal range, so that's good. But she's got the hyporic has gone way over the top high. And then if you look at the fungal, the arabinose is, 57 compared to 93. So the arabinose has come down, but not completely. And then the rest of them are, you know, pretty decent range. So there's still some fungal activity. There's still some. So I would say, you know, I would do a stool test on this person. Yeah, this is a good test to have because you're going to look at what other imbalances she may have as a result of this. But she's still got some gut bugs going on here. And there may be other things. The stool test is going to tell you, does she have a normal flora in the right range? So if you blow in lacto or bifido, and who knows, she may have a genetic marker that, like an FUT2 or something, it's going to make it so that she's just going to need massive doses of bifido in order to do this. She's got some oxalate markers. So,
yes,
you know, I'd be concerned about the oxalate markers. Sometimes it's the oxalates, it's not a genetic thing, and they're not going to have it the rest of their life, but the oxalates are getting into their bloodstream because they have leaky gut. And so addressing the leaky gut, that's the other thing that the stool test will give, is those inflammatory markers, the lysozyme and the lactoferrin and all, to see if they actually have some inflammation going on in the gut.
Which stool test would you recommend she get?
I personally like the doctor's data. I used to do the Genova, and I just don't like it as much. They came up with a lot of false negatives for me in terms of, and they don't always do the full sensitivities. So I kind of been using doctor's data a lot more. If we're looking for H. pylori, which is certainly a possibility, and you can tell me if she has any H. pylori, then you can just run the BioHealth has an H. pylori test, and they seem to be the most accurate for H. pylori. But yeah, she's got a couple of oxalate markers. All of her oxalate markers are high, quite high. Let's see. Her mitochondrial succinate is high. So there's some mitochondrial stuff. So I look at the step. I don't have it memorized, but look at the step right before succinate. It's usually like FAD or NAD, so riboflavin or niacin. That would cause that to go high, so deficiency there. Let's see. You know, her neurotransmitter markers are in range. The quinolinic is a little bit on the high side. The 5-AA is on the low side, so the ratio is off. So that's related to serotonin metabolism. Does she have trouble sleeping? Does she have any anxiety, OCD-type tendencies?
Yeah, she's got restless leg syndrome, so she takes that medication that they give to people with Parkinson's. Pramipexole, so she's on that. She's also on Paxil.
So I would be looking at some things for this. If she have bloating shortly after she eats, like, you know, within an hour or two after she eats.
Yes.
Yeah. So she may have some. She may have some SIBO type things going on, and that might be why this is not clearing up. I would, and I don't like SIBO tests. I just don't, they're a pain to do, and I don't think they're as accurate as they could be. I usually just go by symptoms. But I'm thinking in terms of the migrating motor complex. Does she space her meals? Does she eat close together?
No, she spaces them.
Yeah, is she stressed out?
No, the only thing that she's stressed out about is, you know, having access to a toilet.
Yeah, so I think looking at the stool test is going to be helpful. I think looking at this, you might consider something like MotoPro. It shouldn't increase the transit time, but it would increase the movement from the small to the large. You do have to worry that it might increase the transit time, but it does have a lot of the serotonin indicators, because usually when the serotonin is low, you're going to get lower motility in the gut.
Mm-hmm.
It's high, it increases the motility. But she's got, definitely has low. You want to find out, why does she have irritable bowel? Why is she running to the toilet all the time?
Right.
And so dairy can be as simple as getting dairy. I mean, seriously, if somebody has irritable bowel, the first things you're doing are cleaning up their diet and getting rid of gluten and dairy are big.
Yeah.
Is she overweight?
No.
Okay.
No.
If she's overweight, I was going to say, get her on a juice cleanse. Just get her on green juices for a few days. I would do something where she's on a liquid only or blended only type of an approach for a while, just to get everything calmed down. Because I think, you know, I can't believe they still have her on dairy and they put her back on soy. And
well, he's just taken her off of this. He took her off of dairy and carbohydrates.
Okay. That could have been done right from the start and saved
the
girl a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
Whew. Yeah, so those are the things. But get the stool test. You know, consider possibly some serotonin support, especially if she is anxious and she's on Paxil. Does she have sleep problems?
Well, yeah, because of the restless leg.
Yeah, right. There was some good research on with restless leg, and I can't remember what it was. I mean, a lot of people say magnesium, and it could be, but
you've got good magnesium levels.
Yeah, so let's look at this, uracil, thiamine. So, you know, her folate metabolism might be low, but it's not terrible here. Let's see. Fatty acids, ketones. You know, I'm not really I don't worry about having high ketones as much.
Uh-huh.
But, just because if she is on a low glycemic diet, but she's got the Siberic, and I'd have to look that up to see where. You know, I don't worry about if they have beta-hydroxybutyrate, because that's something that we strive for if we're trying to put them on a ketogenic type diet. Yeah, and, you know, without knowing all the other stuff she's doing, I think calming things down, soothing the lining, definitely working. I usually don't like to just rotate two things because the body does get used to it.
Yeah.
But, you know, back to see what's actually there, what bacteria is actually there. Since you've been doing this for a year, I wouldn't play with it anymore and say, well, let's guess that this will work. Because I see so many times the things that we would guess at, you know, berberine and oregano, and they come back that their bugs are resistant to it. So you waste a lot of time with that. So I'd go right to the stool test. Yeah, riboflavin is low. Remember, we talked about that before. When it's high there, it means that the riboflavin is low. So I suspected that from earlier on in the Krebs cycle. Pantothenic acid, again, that one's off. I don't know if she's supplementing with it.
No.
Yeah.
It's odd. I don't know why that's high.
You don't know why what's high?
Her
acid. Yeah. What could be, is she in a supplement that might have some in it? And the amino acids we don't really look at. Yeah, so those are the things I would look at with this one.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah, so, you know, you've just substantiated what I've been saying all along, which is that she really needs to get a stool test.
I mean, I love getting the oat test because it does give you some indication of what's going on bacterially if there is something, and then you do what you know how to do. You address all the other dysfunctions. But if it's not clearing up, then you want to see what's there. Most people aren't really excited about doing stool tests, so it's a little harder sell than just, hey, pee in this cup. But
uh-huh.
No, it's definitely needed in this case, I think.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay, wonderful. Thank you.
You're welcome, Susan. All right, who else? Questions, comments, concerns, things you want to talk about, clients you're working with? Tell me more. I'm looking to see if I see any more questions typed in. I don't. You guys are quiet. You've got me at your disposal here. Oh, Lynn put up the link to the InstaKetones. All right. Allison, Dr. Allie, hey. Can you hear me there?
Can you hear me?
And now yes. I can. Hey.
Hello there. I'd just like to try and clarify which tests would be best for my daughter, so which investigations should be my next step. She's 16 years old. And she suffers from Raynaud's syndrome and chronic pelvic pain and depression, and she's vomiting after every meal.
Oh.
She's vomiting without appearing to retch. And when we're just sitting eating, she will start regurgitating the food and have to leave the table. And when we were out, one meal a week, she went and had to leave the table three times.
Wow.
And this has been going on for about a year. Now, the pelvic pain is more chronic. She's always had horrendous periods. virtually I feel like she has polycystic ovary syndrome, but the pain is more like endometriosis. Her investigations do not indicate polycystic ovary syndrome. She had a normal pelvic ultrasound, and her hormone test did not indicate PCOS, but she has had problems with acne. So the vomiting is the newest symptom, I wondered whether she had an autoimmune disorder because you've got Raynaud's and you've got vomiting, because there are certain syndromes, like CREST syndrome is an autoimmune disorder like scleroderma that also affects the lower esophagus.
Yeah, but, I mean, I was definitely thinking that lower esophageal sphincter is dysfunctional. It's not holding things down, especially there's no retching. It's just coming up. So yeah. I would be investigating hiatal hernia, and it could be a subtle hiatal hernia, not something that's going to obviously show up, but it could be just a slight, pinning in the diaphragm. And, there's ways to look at that. You can even, you're a doctor, you can look at a YouTube video and figure out how to actually adjust her for an hiatal hernia that way, kinesiologic testing and just a manipulation. So I would look at that for sure. You don't want to get her scoped or anything. It doesn't sound like that's too invasive at this point. If you're concerned about, if you're concerned about the autoimmune and the multiple are autoimmunes, you can be that way, but you can just assume she has one. She probably has some others. Yes. There's certainly the Cyrex lab, Array 5, which will do the complete autoimmune panel. I don't know if they're available over in the UK, but something along those lines, maybe looking at, are there particular autoimmune things affecting the stomach? But chasing down, like trying to identify a bunch of autoimmune things, is expensive, and you probably, given, the socialized medicine aspect of this, they're not going to cover all that. If you go with the Cyrex, it's only $500 compared to if you did each one individually, it'd probably add up to a few thousand. Yeah. So that's one way to look at it. As far as pelvic pain, I definitely want to rule out oxalate sensitivity and the buildup of oxalates. We see that a lot in vulvodynia and pelvic pain, that they're sensitive to oxalates, and you could certainly explore a low oxalate diet, or you can do a 24-hour oxalate urine test for oxalates. Probably the best way to look at that. And then, of course, it's the basics, and I know you've been struggling with her with some of the basic dietary things, but, really getting her on a elimination diet, figuring out food sensitivities, that could be big as far as it. If you've done an ultrasound, you've ruled out pathology, you've ruled out endometriosis and inflammatory disease and polycystic ovaries, it's not a physical change there, then you're thinking about functional stuff. If it's pain, I mean, it could be simple things. There's people that do visceral manipulation. It could be, some adhesion of the ligaments that go to the tubes, that go to the sacrum, the sacrotuberous tube. I can't remember the exact names of them, but there's some ligaments that go from the sacrum. So even, looking and making sure that she's got alignment in her sacrum and her sacroiliac joint and her lumbar spine.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that's really interesting you should say that, because she had scoliosis surgery when she was 11. She's 16 now. So we know that her spine's not going to be perfect. It's much better after surgery, but it doesn't mean she's got rods in there.
Oh, yes, I'm sure she's got the rods in there. I'm sure she's got some adhesions. You might look for somebody who does the Upledger, associated with Upledger Foundation, is a guy named John Burrell, who wrote the book and talked about visceral manipulation, of actually going in and manipulating the viscera and identifying where there's some things. Sometimes there's an intravaginal manipulation that needs to be done to actually get in and kind of feel around on those ligaments and release some of that. But sacral balance is important, and if she had scoliosis and she's had surgery, chances are good that, the alignment and all the nerve innervations and all from the spine, the pelvis, are off. Mm-hmm. That could be contributing. Doesn't mean that she has to live with it. It means that, you have to look into how do you get her some relief from that, especially since you say she's had this problem since she was little and she had the surgery at 11.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, but as far as autoimmune, I would just assume it's autoimmune, so she's got the Raynaud's already. and then just treat it for autoimmune. So working on a leaky gut protocol, heavy metal possibilities, you know, is there any environmental stuff like that? I would look at certainly antioxidants and maybe looking at glutathione and things like that to try to support her in that way. Gluten-free, dairy-free, you know, the whole elimination diet thing. And just talk to her in a way. I know teenagers are really tough to deal with in this regard because they don't want to change things. But when you talk to her about the potentials and you talk to her about this is a trial, we're going to see how you do.
Yeah.
And sometimes just putting them on a really good dose or a really severe, strict elimination diet and then adding doses of the vitamin C and quercetin and omega-3s and things like that to try to just do the foundational nutrition can be major, but definitely at least the adhesion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm echoing on your end.
That's great. So she's gluten and dairy free now. We had her on a larger elimination diet, but it was just so difficult. So she's gone back on. She went back on meat because it was the only way to manage the elimination diet. But
make sure it's organic, especially she can over there.
Yeah. But.
And the fat balance, you know, really focus on her omega-3 fat balance.
Yeah.
Versus the omega-6s, because most people tend to be higher in the omega-6s.
Yeah.
Okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Okay, so Susan and then Tony. Hi, Susan.
Hi there. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I wanted to get your opinion about telomere testing and what telomeres are. It's coming up a lot. I don't know much about it. It seems a bit fascinating, but it's so new. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on it.
Yeah, absolutely. So telomeres are the actual, it's on the DNA, and it's actually the tails almost of the DNA, and they shorten. Every time the DNA replicates, the telomeres get shorter. We found that there are some things that actually help to lengthen the telomeres. So you can actually tell somebody's biological age by testing their telomeres. So if their telomeres are really short, they are heading to disease and, you know, they're going downhill. And if they're strong and long, they're basically healthier. So I know that SpectraCell does some. I know you wrote in Facebook, and I have not had a chance to look at any of those other companies that do it. I haven't done any telomere testing. I know people who have had them done. Recently, somebody who comes to our potlucks had it done, and he said he's like, you know, 58 or something like that, and he had the telomeres of a 40-year-old, so he was thrilled. And then there's things you can do to support that. You know, of course, the general diet, lifestyle, et cetera, good stuff, but there's certain herbs. There's one company that sells this supplement that is out of the reach of the average person. It's like $300 a month for this one supplement, and it's basically an extract of astragalus root. And it's done in such a way, and I don't know if it's really that costly to do or if it's just they've cornered the market and, you know, are using it as a high-end supplement and getting out of business that way. I don't know. But there are others, and if you just look out there and look at telomere support, in general, I think we all should be supporting our telomeres. So, you know, eating right and avoiding oxidized fats and all of those things go a long way, and you accelerate the damage when you do all the negative lifestyle habits. So it's a new and up and coming thing. It's not something that everybody is going to do, because you know, it's expensive to do the testing, and I think we're in the early infancy stages of that now that you did the testing, what do you do with that information?
Right. I was listening to it was an MP3 file that SpectraCell had on their site.
Yep.
There was a doctor from SpectraCell that was talking about the test, which is the most expensive test out there. And it was really interesting because he kept talking about how good statins are for your telomeres. It was a complete turnoff. I couldn't believe it. He kept going back at how good statins are for you, metformin. So, I mean, it completely turned me off of
Petrocell,
you know.
That would turn me off, too. too. Yeah, it's like people look at, you know, there's a double-edged sword to just about everything. You know, you can pick up celery and say, here's all the good things about it and here's all the bad things about it. But in celery's regard, the good things outweigh the bad unless you're eating, you know, drinking 4 quarts of celery juice a day, in which case you might build up some of the toxins in there, and that's true of all of our foods. But people look at the positives. Okay, let's drink a lot of wine because wine, you know, has all these proanthanthins in it and it's supportive and it's antioxidant. But let's look at what it does to the yeast in your gut. Let's look at the acetaldehyde. Let's look at the liver support. And you want to weigh things out. So same thing with statins or metformin. There may be certain constituents in there that are actually supportive. I don't know. I'd have to listen to his research and all. But you have to look at the other end of the sword. Like,
right.
You know, so what can we do that's natural? And that's why, you know, these people are focusing on this extract of astragalus root. And then there's mm-hmm. another company that I think Gabriel Cousins was promoting. Not as expensive as that, but it was supposed to be a product that would help to lengthen the telomeres. So I think it's, you know, it's emerging science. It's new science. There's going to be companies out there that are capitalizing on it and, you know, jumping the gun almost. To say that this is the best thing for it and let's just do this and getting people to pay $300 when there's no way to measure it. Like, okay, sure, 3 years later you can go back and measure your telomeres to see if they've lengthened. I don't think they're going to lengthen in 6 months, but even so, you have to invest a lot. And there's a lot of faith, a lot of blind faith.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a good thing to do. What I would do is research. When we do our genetics module in NEPT, we'll go into this more, but I would be doing research on what are some of the foods and things that are known to damage telomeres, what are the things that are known to support them, and then use this test. You know, for me, lab tests are ammunition to get people motivated to actually do the things we know they should do anyway. Right? I rarely run gluten tests because most of my people, once I convince them that they should go off of it, they'll go off of it. But a lot of people need that. It's like, well, not doing it, it's too hard unless you prove to me. So, okay, let's run this test. And, you know, 99.99% of the time I'm correct because, you know, we know how to clinically assess for this stuff. And same thing with some of the tests. The oat's a little bit different because there's so many different pathways it tests for. But the truth of the matter is when I get back the oat tests after I've been working with somebody for a while and I really know them and have done a really thorough history, there's not always that much new stuff in there. I usually run the tests when, like with your person, like let's do the stool test because we can't figure out what's really going on here. So, you know, a lot of times things just clear up when people are willing to really do dramatic diet lifestyle changes and very targeted diet lifestyle changes, not just eat more vegetables, eat less fat or whatever, but really adapting it. So I think it's new science. I think that if you have somebody that is very scientifically oriented and you're having a hard time convincing them about some of the diet changes, that it could be a good test to do. When it becomes more affordable, I think it's, you know, probably going to be something that doctors are doing, just like everybody should have their DNA tested. You know, everybody should have their telomeres tested. Let's just do this early on so we can motivate and inspire people when they're younger to not do the abusive stuff that most of us have done for many years before we got wise because we got it sick, right? Let's avoid that. But that's my spiel on telomeres.
Okay.
Yeah,
I
think it's great and it's fascinating, and I will be doing a lot more research as I put together the nutrigenomics piece. But
yeah, I think it's still early days, and I think a lot of it's just common sense. We pretty much know what's going to shorten our telomeres.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, we do. We know it, right? And stress is a biggie. Lack of sleep is a biggie. You know, all those things we know.
Yeah.
But some people need to be convinced, so run a fancy test, right?
Right.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks.
And Tony. Hi, Tony.
Hello. Can everyone hear me okay?
I can hear
you
just fine. Yeah.
Oh, great. Okay. So, hi, everybody. I want to kind of support what Allison is doing with her daughter. I have a 20-year-old client, and I'm doing an elimination diet. She's ulcerative colitis. She has that, and her mom is being very supportive of her. And she did everything as far as the elimination that, you know, I put her on, her mother actually monitored. But she said she had to have meat. And that was our compromise, that it had to be clean meat. Because it would have been all or nothing. If I said, oh, you can't do the meat, and then she agreed, and I said, let's do a step down, that's it. But for whatever reason, you know, she just, and not just meat, chicken, she just had to have chicken. But I did tell her that, you know, perhaps once she gets everything fixed up and the minerals are being broken down properly, the need for the meat or the desire, because the craving is probably real because she's not absorbing minerals, she's not breaking down minerals.
Oh, absolutely,
hopefully desire will go away by itself. Because I felt like she really wanted to do it, but she just like, I just felt like I needed it, so.
And a lot of people really are tuned into that. I know people who have been long-term vegetarians and gotten pregnant, for example, and they just were at the edge there that they started craving meat while they were pregnant and tried to avoid it, and finally just gave in and sat down and had, you know, an organically grown, pastured, whatever piece of meat, and the craving went away. And they didn't have to do it consistently, but they did it, and it made a difference. So I think, you know, we're really encouraging people to tune in to the body. Like, what is the body saying? Yeah. For me, sometimes I get the craving. Like at the end of the day, I'm like, why? I want food. Why do I want food? I just ate a ton of food, and I realize, wow, you had a really low fat day today. Your body's craving fat. You need some fat, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'll sit down and I'll have something, and I'll have an avocado or something, and the craving goes away. So I think it's really teaching people how to tune in and differentiate cravings from true needs that are being spoken from inside your body.
She's been really good. I'm so proud of her. She's 20. She goes to school, and it's so easy to do things that are fast and easy and all that. And the other thing that we've been working on, again, baby steps. I mean, she's a young woman, so she's into cosmetics and lotions and potions, and I've been convincing her that everything that you put on your body will go into your body and get absorbed, and it's not good for you. And so instead of telling her to throw away everything in your counter, I said, what one thing can we replace? And she said, we can start with my lotion. So I said, well, she said, what do you use? Your skin looks good. I said, coconut oil. She said, that's it. I said, that's it. So I'm taking her baby steps. So I don't want her to get rid of everything. Because, you know, she's still a young woman. And so anyway, just wanted to share that with
Elsa.
I know Elsa, she's, my question is about someone eating, let's say, sauerkraut, or some sort of fermented food that get any immediate reaction in the stomach, like, ow, that hurts, but it didn't feel good, or it burns. Assuming no allergic reaction to any of the food, like no beef, no allergic reaction.
Yes, assuming she doesn't have a cabbage allergy or something, right? You know, with that, I want to differentiate. So if it's a histamine type reaction, like there's some burning or some, you know, something that indicates that there's some histamine reaction, then it could be that she's been sensitive to histamines. And so going back, that talk that Steph did a couple of weeks ago, which actually it should still be up on Instant Teleseminar. I just haven't put it up on the site yet. But that would be a good thing to be really aware of. It could be a SIBO problem, right? If she eats it and then she immediately feels bloated, it could be a SIBO problem. And the way you could solve that, a couple of ways you can solve that is, one, you have them try making their own sauerkraut, but loading it up with bifidus or other D-lactic acid-free probiotic organisms and see if it's the same thing there. Take a probiotic supplement and see if they get a similar, you know, a general lactobacillus bifidus combination or just lactobacillus and see if that bloats them up. So, or it could be a particular organism that's growing in the cabbage, commercial cabbage versus her own, you know, commercial sauerkraut versus her own, and you don't know what they've put in it, what they've used as a starter. Have they used a starter? Is it just a natural air-fermented type thing, and what was the environment it was done in? So there's a lot of variables there.
Yeah. I'm so glad you said that, because I did tell her, first of all, stop eating it, but secondly, we do need to populate your gut properly, and she's one of these people. I don't have time to make stuff, and so I'm going to teach her how to make a little simple yogurt and use probiotics with bifidus.
Yeah,
because that's a safe one. That's kind of like the conductor, as Steph says, right? That just
The bifidus is safe for most people, and then anything that's a D-lactic acid strain, and there's not that many D-lactic acid free strain, and so So I know that Custom Probiotics, and I think Claire Labs might have one too. And the other thing is I'm lately getting really obsessed with talking about is the the suppository. So if somebody can't take probiotics into the mouth because of a disruption along the way, we make suppositories. I actually spoke about that yesterday on a summit interview for the SIBO summit that's coming up, you know, and they were fascinated with that approach. So, yeah, that's a possibility
as
well.
That was very helpful. Gave me some good starting points here. Thank you.
You're welcome. Good job. All right, so that was, and now we have Melody. Hi, Melody. Unmute yourself, I think. There you go.
Can you hear me? Sorry about that.
I can, yes.
I have a question about vitamin B1.
Okay.
Specifically, the benfothymine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's used for neuropathies, but also for leaky gut and healing the gut, with Hashimoto's.
Yep.
As well. So my question is, the B vitamins are water soluble, but the benfothymine is fat and water soluble. So is there a problem with long-term usage?
You know, in terms of people not, surpassing their fat absorption capacity, is that what you mean?
Well, you know how they say, you know, that's why we really measure the vitamin A and the vitamin D. We keep, like, getting those retested and stuff because of fat.
No, that's different because it has to do with the storage. So the liver will store A, E, K, D because they're fat soluble and it will store them. And when you exceed your capacity, you get too high, you can have negative effects and sluggish liver and, you know, straining the liver. To my understanding, the benfotamine is not stored. It's just a better absorption. You get better absorption to it. I think it might use chylomicrons to get right into the system. But it's not, as far as I know, stored in the liver, which would create problems. But it's a great question.
Well, I had heard, I'm a neuromuscular therapist, so I deal with a lot, and especially cancer-induced neuropathies. And so, you know, it's something that I tell patients, you know, I recommend they're on because of the bioavailability of it. But I had heard this doctor who, I guess, is a leading expert on neuropathies, and he casually mentioned, it was very quick, that he does not like long-term use of this because it's fat soluble. And I was like, wait, where's
more,
that?
Why?
Stop. You know, and I was trying, you know, and then I've been researching and there isn't anything out there. And that on the bottle, it does say fat and water soluble. So now I'm like, okay, is this not good long-term?
You know, you're not seeing any studies for it. So, you know, I think it would be, do some research on liver buildup. Does benfotamine get stored in the liver? Does it build up over time? It's not my understanding that it does. It's kind of like B12, right? We don't overdose on B12. The liver can store up to 7 years' worth, but unlike the fat-soluble vitamins, usually people don't overdose on it. They just pee out whatever they don't need. If they've got a full liver, first of all, you've got the absorption that goes down. But if your liver storage of, say, B12 is up, most of the water-soluble vitamins are not stored in the liver. It's just the fat-soluble and the B12. But even with the B12, once you reach capacity in the liver, it actually decreases the absorption rate of the B12 to protect you from overdose. And then, you know, there's an elimination rate, and the transporters go down and all that.
When we're looking at the genetic SNPs, if anyone has the phase two, like, you know, slow, you know, like the COMP genes and stuff like that, would that be a concern then? I don't know. It's all new, and I'm trying to look into it.
Yeah, no, it's good questions. I would love to know more, but I wish I had the answer. I mean, my sense is telling me that it's not a problem Well, I mean, certainly anything that you do a very, very large dose is like with leaky gut, I usually use short term, I'll do 150 milligrams three times a day. Well, that's three times, no, that's like 10 times, probably, yeah, it's probably 100 times. I mean, it's a huge amount more than what's considered the RDA, but
right.
We're using it therapeutically. So, you know, anything long-term excessive could be problematic, but I don't know that it's because it's that form or if any long-term supplementation would be one if you're doing that much. Same thing with vitamin B6. You can do doses that are a lot of times higher than the RDA, but once you get into like 500 or more on a regular basis, it can contribute to neuropathies. So
it can be like a rebound effect. So when they're taking it for neuropathy, it actually can cause neuropathy.
Yeah, but B6 can cause neuropathy in anybody. It doesn't matter if they're taking it for neuropathy or not. That's what the studies show when you do long-term supplementation of 500 milligrams or more. Most people don't take that much.
Right.
When they did, it was very high. But with the, you know, with the benzodiamine, I personally use it for short periods of time at 150 three times a day, which is a very high dose, but I'm doing it for like a three-month leaky gut program.
Right. I've been having patients do 250 milligrams life extension, the mega benzothiamine, for 250 milligrams just once a day. So you're getting a hefty dose, but it's just once.
It's certainly worth more research. Definitely worth more research.
Like your other things that you have spoken about, would it be then realistically, if someone's taking it because this is more long-term, would it be good to like finish the bottle and then go back to straight, just a regular, thiamine, and then circle back into it like
you
that?
You could do that. You can rotate it in and out. I think that, you know, I don't know. I don't have specifics. I mean, my guess is that 3 months would be good numbers, and then maybe go off of it. And if you feel like they need it again, you can circle back to it, but put them on just a regular B1 supplement. But I think more research is required. Who is this guy? Does he have a website that you can find him and ask him a question?
I do. I'll try to list it. I'll look it up and I'll look him up because it was very, I had never thought about it before. And it was just like one of those things that just caught my attention. It was like, oh my goodness, wait, stop.
And you want to know why. So yeah, it'd be great to have his email address or his website where you can type in a question and ask like what's the research on that?
Okay. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. You're welcome. My pleasure. Yeah, good question. Stumped me. You stumped me, Melody. Okay, I'm going to go. I don't see any more hands up, so I'm going to go back to the Q&A. I'll refresh the Q&A, and I don't see anything there. I'll go back to the chat, and... I don't see anything more in there. Lynn did post the Burrell Institute. He's the one I was mentioning with the visceral manipulation. Dr. Ellie says even classically thiamine is used in high doses for alcoholics. Yeah, they will do like a Myers cocktail type of thing. I mean, I was talking to somebody who said even they don't do Myers cocktails per se, but when somebody comes in and they're really in a bad state alcoholically, they just dose them up with the B vitamins. But she said even in the NHS they do that. Lynn says 900 milligrams, 3 times 300 benfotiamine daily for 12 weeks in diabetics with moderate levels of urinary albumin failed to reduce serum or urinary ages in a trial, but that was not saying anything about a danger. She also put in two different PubMed studies. Let's see what they have to say. Protective effective treatment with thiamine and benfotiamine on liver oxidative damage in rats. Even 30 minutes of it is proven to be beneficial against liver damage. So, but it doesn't talk long term. That's, you know, it'd be nice to find a study that talks about it, the long term use. Effective benzodiamine on advanced glycation end products and markers of endothelial dysfunction. They were looking to see if benzodiamine would decrease the ages, and that's where they found that they didn't really, the advanced glycation end products. Good studies, Lynn. Thank you. Not necessarily exactly what we're looking for. So it looks like there's not really a lot of stuff out there. So be curious to find out from this guy. Okay, I don't see any more questions there. I'll check one more time on the Q&A. I'll come back, and I don't see any hands. So thank you all for being here, for your attention. If any other questions do come up, you know, have a chat on the Facebook group. I know we do a lot of that chatting, so there's not always questions that come up for these calls, but I'm here to support you and appreciate it. And I think for those in NEPT, we have another, our next call's next week. I'm actually out of town from tomorrow through Sunday, and I'm actually out of the office this afternoon doing a local meetup group and doing a talk on food as medicine for them. So next week, let's see what we have. I think next week we have an IRSPT on Tuesday night at 7:30 for those of you in that program. For those of you in NEPT, we have a call, an open office hours call on Thursday. All right, and then the following week we don't have anything, I don't think, except for the NEPA, the Practice Accelerators, because that's when we're getting ready for our live event, our Spring into Vitality. Those of you who want to come to it, you do get a free ticket, I think, as part of your program. And if you didn't get a link to that, then write to us, helpdesk@dradenmarie.com. Tell us which program you're in, and we'll make sure we send that to you. We're having a great event. I'm sorry that not everybody can make it, that I would love to be there, but it's going to be a grand time. So thanks, everybody. I'm going to open up the line so you can say goodbye. Bye, everybody.
Goodbye. Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye. Thank you.